the Holocaust seems to me to be the paradigmatic case of the acting out of unconscious fears and fantasies, projections and so on, onto an other group that has ever occurred. And the place, therefore, for psychoanalytic concepts in understanding anti-Semitism and racism more generally, but particularly in this context, in thinking about Nazism and Nazi perpetrators, is crucial, especially given, I think for me, what's so interesting about this is not just thinking as a historian, how can I borrow psychoanalytic ideas to enrich the thing I'm interested in explaining, but also because the history of psychoanalysis is also bound up with these, with this history. I mean, that's also why I wanted to cite Fenichel and Loewenstein, the idea of psychoanalysis as the Jewish science, being of the emigres all persecuted by Nazism who had to restart their lives in the US or elsewhere, the grappling with the German psychoanalysts after the war, the conflicts in the international psychoanalytic associations after the war. This is all part of the history of the Holocaust in a way. And so for me, this combination of the history of psychoanalysis as an endeavor, plus the usefulness, as I see it, of psychoanalytic concepts in trying to explain this phenomenon in the first place, is a hugely enriching conversation.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Professor Dan Stone. Professor Stone is a professor of modern history and the director of the Holocaust Research Institute at Royal Holloway University of London, where he has taught since 1999. Our conversation today revolves around a recent book of his entitled Psychoanalysis, Historiography, and the Nazi Camps, Accounting for Survival. And in it, we consider the question of trauma, the various ways that psychoanalysts have considered trauma over our history. And he moves the discussion further and beyond trauma, and that is survival. What contributes to people surviving trauma? And he, being a Holocaust historian, he uses the concentration camps as the example of overwhelming massive trauma in adult life, and considers how one understands the survival mechanisms. And to be clear, from the very beginning, everyone he quotes and his own research beyond that, it is very clear that the most important factor contributing to survival is luck.
And everything about our conversation is beyond that. What can we learn from, given that luck is the key variable? Is there anything else that might contribute to the tendency for some people to survive? And he uses two analysts who have conflicting points of view about it as examples of these different perspectives. One is Viktor Frankl, who was very well known, and one is Eddie de Wind, a Dutch analyst who survived the war and practiced long after the war and was one of the forerunners of our current concept of post-traumatic stress disorder. Dan is widely published. He's written The Holocaust, An Unfinished History, Fate Unknown, Tracing the Missing After World War II and the Holocaust. And he is also the co-editor of Volume 1 of Cambridge History of the Holocaust. He chaired the Academic Advisory Committee for the Imperial War Museum's London Redesigned Holocaust Galleries, and he is a member of the UK's Advisory Group on Spoliation Matters. He is truly a scholar of this area. I learned a great deal in reading his book and in our conversation, and I hope you find it as meaningful as I do. Here is my conversation with Professor Dan Stone. Dan, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The concept of trauma is one that we hear a great deal about in our field in psychoanalysis in recent years. And it seems to me that insofar as it alerts us, this concept alerts us to the importance and presence of external factors impinging our life throughout our life. And these are factors that might otherwise be overlooked. I think it is to the good that we highlight the presence of trauma in all of our lives in different degrees. On the other hand, there's also a risk that in focusing on external trauma, we diminish or distract ourselves from a full appreciation of the power of unconscious conflict and fantasy to themselves act as dead weights on our emotional life energy. And this balance between external and intrapsychic is one that has long been well known, and Freud referred to it as the complemental series. There's also been debate about the relative impact of childhood trauma versus adult trauma. And the adult trauma side is the focus of your book that we're here to discuss today. And the paradigmatic example you use to demonstrate and take up this issue of later adult trauma is the Holocaust and the concentration camp experience. Now, this issue of external and internal has been a source of controversy. But what you bring our attention to and what's noteworthy about your work is that you move us forward beyond just the nature of the trauma and the timing of the trauma, but the issue of survival. Rarely does one hear in the literature or in conversation what enabled somebody to survive. And this applies both to childhood situations and adult situations, which is what you're going to focus on. And you bring forward two sets of ideas, again, debatable in the psychoanalytic world, as we tend to be, two different points of view about how we understand survival. And you have a number of analyst survivors who contribute to the literature, and we're going to discuss their work. The best known ones with differing points of view is the well-known Viktor Frankl, and the less well-known, Eddie de Wind. And we're going to spend some time on each of them. But before we do that, I want to set the stage by reading the beginnings of your book where you have, where you take up the issue of trauma and early versus late trauma, that debate. And you write, "The move away from regarding psychological problems as responses to childhood sexual abuse in a universally applicable psychosexual development, in favor of a model in which the psychic illnesses are understood as impacted by events in the external world later in life, clearly owes a great deal to and was in turn defined through the notion of trauma, for which the Holocaust and other horrific events beginning with World War I have been crucial. Want to start us off with that?
Sure. I think the concept of trauma has jumped considerably from the world of psychoanalysis and psychology in general, and has become, I think, as we all know, a common term in everyday speech. It's become a common analytic tool in cultural studies, literary studies, memory studies, other niche parts of the humanities. It's a concept that runs the risk of becoming so widely used that it becomes almost meaningless, in the sense that if everything is traumatic, you know, if you walk down the street and trip over the pavement, is that a trauma? In that sense, the ubiquitous nature of the trauma concept is problematic. And there's some very good literature by scholars in literary and historical disciplines who have alerted us to the problematic use of what should essentially be a clinical concept in the humanities setting. Nevertheless, it's also, I think, when used well, opened our eyes to aspects of human experience that are not easily graspable through, from a historian's point of view, documents, texts, even memoirs, diaries, ego documents. There are aspects of life, psychoanalysts know this, of course, through the concept of the unconscious, that are not easily accessible to rational comprehension. And in that sense, the concept of trauma provides a useful way of thinking, as long as it's used carefully, I think. But here, in this book, because I am a historian, I'm interested in historicizing the way in which the idea of trauma developed. I mean, it has a history, of course. I think that's also quite well known. Of course, one can find discussions in ancient texts of things that might seem to us to be references to trauma. But in the modern sense, let's say from the late 19th century onwards, with ideas about neurasthenia or railway spine, through shell shock and so on, these are concepts that form the basis of the modern concept of trauma, as it eventually came to be defined in 1980 in the DSM. And the Vietnam War, I mean, you know, because you've written about this, obviously was crucial in this respect. But so, I think, was the first decades after World War II, the concept of concentration camp syndrome, survivor syndrome, and so on. This grappling with the symptoms that Holocaust survivors showed brought to light in many ways this debate between internal, external effects and the concept of trauma. You can see it being foreshadowed in some of the writings of the analysts that I discuss in the book.
And one of the pleasures for me in reading your book was to recognize that the analysts were not all of one mind. That is, that in the 1970s, when the term PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, was created, and it was argued over, because there were many in the analytic community who felt, and I thought somewhat reasonably, that it would turn away from understanding early childhood antecedents to adult trauma. And they argued that position, I think, beyond reasonableness. What I learned from your writing is that there were at least two that you mentioned and that we will mention later, who really contributed to the concept of post-traumatic stress disorder. Analysts who, from their clinical work and their work with Holocaust survivors and their own experiences, appreciated that, yes, we all bring personalities to our life stories, but our life stories have their own life and energy and pathogenic power. And one of them is Eddie DeWind. And let me use that to ask you to introduce two of the characters who represent these different points of view, Viktor Frankl and Eddie DeWind. Tell us a little bit about them, and then we will get into how they see things differently.
I think Frankl, probably for listeners here, doesn't need very much introduction. I mean, his book Man's Search for Meaning, probably of his many publications, that I think no doubt the best known, is permanently on top of any bestseller list of Holocaust-related literature.
Yeah, amazingly so, yeah.
Incredible. It's been in print for basically continuously since it was first published in 1946. And it sells in huge numbers of copies, and it's read by book groups all over the world. And I think found powerful by many readers. Of course, he's also the founder of a school of psychotherapy, of logotherapy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not qualified from a clinical perspective to talk about its usefulness or not. I think that's not the issue for me here. People find it helpful, and that's fine. I think that what he has to say about survival in the Holocaust, however, is very problematic. I'm not the first person to note this. The literary scholar Lawrence Langer, who died last year at the age of 92, he brutally attacked Frankl in one of his early publications in the early 1980s for banalizing the Holocaust and treating it as a mental health problem. In other words, Frankl, much like his, I suppose, equally well-known but less well-qualified colleague, Bruno Bettelheim, argued essentially that although chance was important in surviving the Holocaust, the people who tended to survive were those who had a rich inner life or the inner resources to be able to think positively and get themselves into a mental position where they were able to think past the events that they were living through. That might be true for some survivors. I don't want to take an inhumane position that says this is simply not the case. I'm sure there are, I mean, that one can find examples of memoirs written after the war by survivors who say this. You know, I was determined mm-hmm. to stay alive, and I did. The problem is that I'm sure that among the millions of victims of the Holocaust, there were many who were determined to stay alive, but who did not. And therefore, I find this argument of Frankl's to be demeaning of the victims, essentially. But it's an extremely well-known position. And therefore, for me, the existence of alternative theories of survival, also penned by practicing psychoanalysts, is very important because it suggests that there's an alternative way of thinking about this issue. And De Wint, who you mentioned, is, I think, relatively unknown, or was until recently, because he was born in 1916. He grew up in The Hague in the Netherlands. He studied medicine in The Hague. And then at the start of the war, moved to Amsterdam, where he trained clandestinely as a psychoanalyst until he was captured and sent to first to Westerbork, the transit camp in the Netherlands, and then on to Auschwitz, where he worked as an inmate physician. At the end of the war, once the camp was liberated, he remained a bit like Primo Levi. He remained behind in Auschwitz when the camp was when the inmates were sent on the so-called death march, the forced evacuation before the arrival of the Red Army. He was among the 7,000 or so who remained behind. And once the Red Army arrived, he volunteered to assist them and continued working as he had during the existence of the camp as an inmate physician. And during that time, before the war was even over, he wrote this memoir called Last Stop Auschwitz, which was first published in Dutch in 1946. And was published, it was kind of rediscovered and then published in numerous languages just a few years ago. So in English and many other European languages. And since then, it's become quite a well-known book. And it's not written as a memoir. He writes it, he doesn't describe himself. He uses an alter ego called Hans, but it is quite clearly an autobiographical account of the camp. And when you read it and then compare it with his clinical writings from the late 40s through to the late 1970s, early 1980s, there's a very interesting comparison to be made with the arguments of Frankl, in that De Wint suggests that rather he certainly has no problem with saying that thinking positively was a good thing if one could, but his main argument for survival is that those who survived were those who neither fought the system, because that was a sure way to get murdered, or those who slipped totally into despair. Rather, they were those who fell into what he calls a kind of stupor-like state. I think in, maybe in psychoanalytic vocabulary, that would be something more like depersonalization.
Dissociative state also.
Or some kind of dissociative state. Exactly so. Where the inmate is able to function, but essentially shuts down a large proportion of their mental faculties. So no kind of forward thinking, no dreams and hopes, just getting through the day, being able to provide the right answer to the guard when addressed, keeping oneself hidden away, is in a sense just kind of functioning on a kind of primitive level on a day-by-day basis. And De Vint's argument, what's interesting is that his argument there is somewhat at odds with the account he gives of his own survival, but it's nevertheless based on his clinical observations with survivors that he treated in the post-war period.
Let me read what you wrote about that stupor state. You say in his book, Confrontation with Death, which was first published in 1949, he argues that in order to survive the concentration camp, the inmate had neither to, quote, surrender completely nor to resist with all his vitality. Both were sure paths to death. Rather, he proposed the paradox that reconciling oneself to death was a vital condition for the prisoner, and that what he called the death principle, which he named so as to be distinguishable from Freud's death drive, which in ordinary life would be kept at bay, was a necessity in the camp. The inmate, in other words, had to develop a camp psyche, a state of stupor, that did not completely dominate, but was characterized by a form of inner acceptance of death, tempered by the preservation of just enough vitality to give the right answer at critical moments. We should say, in fleshing out these various theories of survival, that all the authors and all the literature make clear that the first, second, and third element that contributed to survival was luck. And we want to put that front and center because it's true, and it frames how we understand everything else that we're speaking of.
Yes, because when we talk, for example, about what Nederland called concentration camp syndrome or survivor syndrome, or when we think about the concept of survivor guilt, that's fundamental to understanding it. This sense of guilt, why did I survive when my family, my whole community, and so on were destroyed, is otherwise not understandable without the concept of luck. Or, luck is slightly problematic because it implies good luck, but right. Chance, let's say, is the crucial condition here. I think once we have that as the starting point, then we're in a position to ask questions about how the experience of being a victim of the Holocaust changed one's psychic apparatus, or how one's mental state had to adapt to being in a camp or in hiding and so on, and how some of those adaptive responses could help, but then could later perhaps reappear in problematic way after the war, after surviving,
right.
Could then reappear as problematic or traumatic experiences.
You mentioned a number of times that the authors refer to being able to answer a question in the best way possible. And when I read that, I didn't quite understand what that meant. Let me ask you to read an example of that from your book. It's the one on page 34.
This comes from Ellie Cohen's...
You want to say something about who he is? Yeah.
Yes. So Cohen... also, it might be known to some listeners, he was also a Dutch Holocaust survivor. He was older than a little older than De Vint, and he studied as a general. He studied medicine and worked as a general practitioner. So he was not a psychoanalyst, but his PhD, which he obtained shortly after the war in 1951-52, was published as Human Behavior in the Concentration Camp, and has been in print in English for many decades, and is quite a well-known book, and is a largely Freudian reading of the psychology of the inmates and the psychology of the guards. So it's essentially a psychoanalytic study of the perpetrators and of the victims of the Holocaust. He also published an autobiography in Dutch. It's the title, the subtitle is an ego document, which is which I think is quite revealing, and it's called The Abyss. And here it's a much more personal work than Human Behavior in the Concentration Camp, and it's a very difficult read because, unlike accounts by many Holocaust survivors, he's very tough on himself. He refers to himself as a collaborator. You know, he says, "My life was saved because I was a doctor in the camps. I had a privileged position." Mm-hmm. But then he accuses himself of having been a collaborator and having gone too far, and so on. It's very hard to take. I think most historians today would not agree with him that he was a collaborator. Nevertheless, there's clearly an inner conflict going on inside his mind as to how to grapple with what had happened. Unlike de Wint and another Dutch survivor, Louis Michiels, who we'll talk about as well, Cohen's first wife and child were murdered in Auschwitz. And so his whole experience was rather different from de Wint's, let's say. So in The Abyss, he says, when cleaning windows one time in the ward, a high-ranking SS man asked him what he was doing, and he replied that he'd been ordered to clean the windows. And then Cohen writes, "And then I could actually see that man thinking. I myself, of course, was standing stiffly at attention. And yes, I was looking at him. And I don't think I have ever been so close to death as at that moment. If I had batted an eyelid then, or had been wearing the wrong look, a smile on my face, or had looked afraid or whatever, then one nod from him, no more, just one nod of his head, would have been enough. Apparently he didn't see anything so frightful in me, or anything unpleasant, or, I don't know. I don't know how I acted. Anyway, he turned on his heels and off he went. Looking back, that was the most frightening moment I experienced there." So he then agrees with Frankl and de Wint that a spiritual life added to the chances of survival. He goes further, adding, and I quote him again, "The next condition essential for adaptation was the lowering of one's own spiritual standard." So in contrast to Frankl, it's the lowering of the spiritual standard rather than the focus on it that is crucial for survival.
The deadening of oneself. But
exactly.
What's better known, at least visually, if not conceptually, is the Musselman, who lowered it to bare biological survival. Can you help us contrast the two?
I think the figure of the Musselman, which is the German term for Muslim, it's a strange term, I guess, comes from some kind of racial stereotyping that existed among the inmates of the camps. I think the figure of the Musselman is best known from Primo Levi's memoirs, and the Musselman describes an inmate who had basically given up. Someone who had become a Musselman was, to all intents and purposes, already dead. There was no coming back once one had reached that stage. This was somebody, it's not right, I don't think it's right to say who had given up, but somebody who had been beaten by the system of the concentration.
The life beaten out of them, yeah.
Life had been beaten out of them. They their physical capacity for survival had gone beyond the point at which any recuperation was possible. So there were these figures wandering around for a few days at a time before they finally expired. And what de Wint and Cohen are describing is something, I think, subtly different. That's to say, the lowering of one's own spiritual standards does not necessarily mean an abandonment of all desire to live or a complete devastation, physically speaking. So these are people who had adjusted and, in a sense, given up on what would have been their normal life expectancies or expectations before being in the camp, but who had not completely given up all hope of surviving.
Now, do you think it's fair or accurate to say that de Wint's way of thinking did lay the groundwork for later PTSD? Because he published a great deal on this, because he survived the war, obviously, and he practiced as a psychoanalyst and leans into the importance of adult trauma as contrasted with, if one needs to make a contrast, with early developmental trauma. Do you think that's fair to see him as one of the forerunners?
I do think so. What's interesting is the way in which, from the piece that you just cited, Confrontation with Death in 1949, through to his later publications in the 70s and up to the early 80s, you can also trace a kind of change in his own thinking about this dilemma about internal external effect. In some of the earlier pieces, he's still saying, well, when external events have this impact, it must be because they are triggering unconscious experiences of event of childhood events and fantasies and so on that are already there. And as time passes, he starts to leave that behind more and more, and to place more stress on massive psychic trauma brought about by the external events themselves. And here, I think he's by no means alone. I mean, you can see him along with Anna Ornstein, Henry Kristall, William Nederland, Hans Kielsen, Leo Eitinger, and other analysts who are also grappling with the same problem. And particularly Kristall, with his concept of massive psychic trauma, and Lifton and others, you see this attack, really, for various reasons, not simply due to internal debates within psychoanalysis, but because of other external issues that are going on in wider society and culture. You can see this attack on the orthodox position taking shape. And De Wint is definitely, I think, somebody whose contribution to that process has been overlooked.
And you mentioned another figure who, as I mentioned, also isn't well known, but should be. It's Hilde Bloom. And she wrote a paper, apparently an esteemed paper at the time. It's called How Did They Survive? Mechanisms of Defense in Nazi Concentration Camps. And it was published in 1948. And she, you write, her starting point is a realistic one. One cannot ask about the psychic mechanisms that contributed to survival without first noting that these mechanisms were by no means the most important factor contributing to survival. But if the factor of accident or terror governed the camp and ruled over the inmate's life and death, it must therefore also have had an impact on the inmate's psychic life, and it is the latter in which Bloom is primarily interested. And she, very much in parallel with De Wint, comes up with her own notions of how one deadened oneself. She uses slightly different language. Our field loves different words, but it's describing essentially the same thing. And she makes a fascinating comment on the importance of being able to write, the self-reflection that leads one to be able to write. Let me ask you to read that. That's on the bottom of page 72.
What did Bloom see as the characteristics of estrangement? She points to three aspects: depersonalization, self-observation, and self-expression, all of which count as protective blocking mechanisms. In depersonalization, the ego of the prisoners refused to accept the estrangement it was subjected to, with the result that it turned the experiences connected with the loss of its feelings into an object of its intellectual interests. This in turn produced the urge to self-observation. By turning its inner development into an object of investigation, the ego makes the first attempt to restore its contact with the world of objects from which it had withdrawn under the impact of initial trauma. Finally, and crucially, as Bloom notes, in the case of our authors, suggesting that this might not always be the case, the healthy component of self-observation was strengthened by an additional and most essential factor. Luckier than their less articulate comrades, they were privileged by the relieving gift of self-expression. Self-observation and self-expression were interrelated, with each generating the other. Many of the authors in Bloom's study attest to a feeling of observing themselves and a desire to write, and vice versa. This ability, she asserts, was a reassurance that the therapeutic component of the fever would predominate over the element of disease. It's perhaps important to note that the Bloom's article is a kind of review article of a dozen publications that had been that had appeared since the earliest is 1935 and through to several published during the war and several published in the immediate post-war period by authors who had some experience of being incarcerated by the Nazis. And she's using their texts in order to address this question of what happens to the psyche under these conditions and what conditions permit survival.
And you read through all those papers you wrote.
Yes.
This notion of estrangement, whether it's called that or stupor or dissociation, seems to capture a thread that characterizes a survival mechanism that can cause all kinds of difficulties, as you said, later in life, when that's the only way of coping one knows.
Yes, it does. And what's interesting about the study, I mean, I think of myself as a historian of ideas, and so I wanted to reread first her paper and then the text that she writes about, not in order to ask whether she was right or wrong, but to historicize the ideas and say, how do the ideas that Bloom put forward in 1948 stack up today, given the developments that have taken place in, firstly, in psychoanalytic theory, and secondly, in Holocaust historiography. And it's the sort of scholarly exercise that I find, first of all, quite enjoyable, and second, quite helpful from a historical point of view, because it helps you to understand how concepts have changed over time. And so included in her dozen texts are an early version of Bettelheim's famous Journal of Abnormal Psychology article about human behavior in the extreme situation, and an early German version of what became Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. But there are also in there a couple of other texts that remain quite well known, like David Rousset's book, L'Univers Concentrationnaire, published in English as A World Apart in the late 1940s. But also a few texts by former inmates who became psychoanalysts, like Ernst Feden, but also several texts by former victims that have become that are now unknown. So Stefan Sender's book. What's it called? Well, for example, Ernst Wiechert's book, The Forest of the Dead. Wiechert was quite a well-known novelist in Germany at the time. I think is very little known today outside of Germany and outside of a few specialists. A book by Christopher Burney, an English author who had spent time in German prisons, and the other ones I'm thinking of, Leon Schallet's book Experiment E, another early account published in 1945 of one of the early Nazi prisons, and so on. So there's a range of texts, but what's really important about all of them is that, with a couple of exceptions, none of the authors were Jewish, and all of them had not experienced what we would call now the Holocaust. That's to say, they had been in Nazi prisons or camps before the war, or for a brief period during the war. They had not experienced the death camps. The only exception in her list is the Polish author Severina Szmaglewska, whose book Smoke Over Birkenau was published also shortly after the war, one of the first published accounts of Auschwitz published after the war. But she was a Polish Catholic inmate, and she writes about what happened to the Jews in the book, but did not experience them herself. Neither did the only other exception in her list, which is Benedict Kautsky's book, Devils and the Damned. He was also incarcerated as a political prisoner for more or less the duration of the Third Reich. And he also writes in passing about what happened to the Jews, but they, when it comes to understanding their own psychic responses to their persecution, Bloom's insights, which are, I think, extremely interesting and compelling, nevertheless don't help us understand the same kind of traumatic expressions that Holocaust survivors of the sort treated by de Wint and others after the war were displaying.
I want to focus on this issue of historicizing our field. In your concluding chapter, you write, "Each discipline needs to be historicized, but that when juxtaposed, they offer a vocabulary, an analytical approach, and a style of approaching past action that can provide powerful explanations for phenomena that appear to exceed the limits of rational assessment. Confronted with the massive trauma of Nazism and the Holocaust, some psychoanalysts argued that their discipline has nothing to offer. Others suggested that analysis could in some cases be used, but only with great care. Similarly, historians debated whether their inherently empirical and rational discipline had the tools to explain the Holocaust. Although there will never be a completely satisfactory explanation, I argue that employing psychoanalytic terms helps in grappling with the monstrosity of the Nazi crimes and their effects on the Nazi victims." In your conclusion, you quote two very well-known analysts, Otto Fenichel and Rudolf Lowenstein, on anti-Semitism, which is not the focus of your book. And I'm going to ask you to read the quotes from your book on it, and then I'm going to ask you about what led you to put that in the book.
Okay. So in 1940, Otto Fenichel began an article on the psychoanalysis of anti-Semitism with the words, "Please do not expect too much from me. Anti-Semitism is a complicated phenomenon." Just a few years after the end of World War II, the Yale psychoanalyst Rudolf M. Loewenstein noted that what we would now call the Holocaust had not ended anti-Semitism. And I quote him, "Long before the end of World War II, it was easy to foresee that the defeat of Nazi Germany would not put an end to anti-Semitism. On the contrary, it could be expected to continue both in Europe and America. For the Nazis had replenished the store of historical causes that form the permanent stockpile of anti-Semitism. They had broadcast lies, which, however fantastic, had obtained credence and would continue to have repercussions throughout the world. They had demonstrated that it was relatively easy to persecute Jews and even to exterminate them with impunity. And above all, they left in the wake of their defeat an impoverished, ravaged, ruined, weakened Europe, a Europe more deeply torn politically than perhaps ever before in her history." So I wanted to include those because although the main focus of my book is not anti-Semitism, I'm interested from a historian's point of view in the early texts that were published in the immediate post-war period and in the years shortly before the end of the war, in terms of how Holocaust historiography has developed. There are a lot of early texts that have been neglected that historians have been rediscovering in recent years. And although the focus of the book is on survival, nevertheless, I think that psychoanalytic concepts are valuable not just for thinking about the victims, but also for thinking about the perpetrators. And that's something that I've only really touched on in this very short book. But the Holocaust can be written about by historians using, you know, our traditional methods of reading documents, tracing institutional developments. For example, the history of the decision-making process for the final solution. We can use documents to show who said what to whom, when, which organizations were involved, try and understand the relative importance, let's say, of the SS with respect to the Wehrmacht or the Office for the Four-Year Plan or whatever other agency in the context of the Third Reich. We can show through documents the role of collaboration across Europe in the final solution, etc., etc. But trying to think about why the Jews were targeted by the Nazis and their accomplices is a harder task. And it can also be done through tracing the history of anti-Semitism in texts and movements and so on. But the Holocaust seems to me to be the paradigmatic case of the acting out of fears and fantasies, unconscious fears and fantasies, projections and so on, onto another group that has ever occurred. And the place, therefore, for psychoanalytic concepts in understanding anti-Semitism and racism more generally, but particularly in this context, in thinking about Nazism and Nazi perpetrators, is crucial, especially given, I think for me, what's so interesting about this is not just thinking as a historian, how can I borrow psychoanalytic ideas to enrich the thing I'm interested in explaining, but also because psychoanalysis, the history of psychoanalysis, is also bound up with these, with this history. I mean, that's also why I wanted to cite Fenichel and Loewenstein, the idea of psychoanalysis as the Jewish science, being of the émigrés all persecuted by Nazism who had to restart their lives in the US or elsewhere, the grappling with the German psychoanalysts after the war, the conflicts in the international psychoanalytic associations after the war. This is all part of the history of the Holocaust in a way. And so for me, this combination of the history of psychoanalysis as an endeavor, plus the usefulness, as I see it, of psychoanalytic concepts in trying to explain this phenomenon in the first place, is a hugely enriching conversation.
So beautifully put. And it pairs up with the final sentence in your book, which I will read. You write, "We see that just as psychoanalysis without history cannot provide meaningful insights into social structures and dynamics, so history without psychoanalysis cannot access aspects of the human experience that elude rational thought, and these are sadly many." Dan, I want to thank you for this book. It is, again, the title of it's called Psychoanalysis, Historiography, and the Nazi Camps, Accounting for Survival. It is a very readable book. It's a fairly short book, but it's readable because it's not jargon-filled. It's real, as you can hear from the breadth of your knowledge and scholarship. This is a real deep dive into how we understand trauma, and in particular, how we understand survival, and who are the characters who have contributed to it. And you have done a good deed, as it were, to bring forward some of these folks who have not been well known at all in recent years. And perhaps others like myself will enjoy immersing themselves in your work. So I want to thank you for your research and for sharing it so eloquently for us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for the invitation to appear here.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.